All right, it's good to have you all here tonight, and also you people out in internet land, the digital men out there. I just wanted to say something briefly. I'm not going to walk through the entire syllabus, but I did want to give a chance to just talk about the fact that this is, you see, the syllabus is entitled Augustinian Church History and Historical Theology II. I think you'll see the title Medieval Reformation Church History as well, all one and the same. I'm going to explain when I come to the lecture a little bit about the method to this whole approach to church history. I think you saw from the email today that a lot of the texts that you're required to read for the class are available online digitally, so you don't need to purchase them. But the two books you do need to purchase are Peter Brown's Augustine of Hippo, which is the authoritative biography of Augustine of about 500 pages, and also J.N.D. Kelly's Early Christian Doctrines. And you see there are selected chapters that you need to read out of there. But besides that, the works, the anti-Pelagian works of Augustine that are mentioned in the required text and the other selected Reformation documents, those are all available online and in the and now in your syllabus, the new one you received today, where you can find them is outlined. Okay? Let's see. There will be four exams for this course. I will hand out study questions for each of those exams a week before they're handed out so you can comb through the notes for the answers. And as well, you see there's a 100-point question notebook because I want you to be thinking while you're reading, sometimes a novel idea. But let's do that. Other thing that is mentioned in the schedule of lectures is that these lectures will be supplemented by the four test hours outside of class and a two-hour group discussion with the professor to be scheduled at the mutual convenience of students and professor. Now, I'm not quite sure how that's going to, we're going to work that out for the online students. We will work it out for you, but for the residential students, we'll get together maybe some Saturday or whatever works for you, and we'll have a two-hour group discussion, and I'm thinking right now we'll talk about Augustine's anti-Pelagian works and just work through questions, comments, and discuss some things that come out of those works that may be of interest to you. Then the syllabus ends with the course outline. Now, if any of you have any questions about this that you don't think of right now, especially you people out online, then please write me and take advantage of the email that we have, and I will answer any question you have about this. And there may be any number of things that I haven't been able to work out. And then I do want to say that, ask if you have any questions here tonight, especially Ben or Eric. All right, let's pray together. Father, we thank you for the fact that you're real and you work in the history of your people, even in the lives of men and women like ourselves that were not your inspired apostolic and prophetic servants. And we thank you for particularly the man Augustine. And we ask that as we study his works tonight, as we study his life, as we study what you did in his life, that it might be of great profit to us. We ask these things in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. All right, part one of the course is entitled Augustinian Beginnings. And I want to talk about the whole subject. I'm sorry I'm ducking here, but I'm looking for some pens. I want to talk about the whole subject of how I've approached the study of church history, or more properly, because this is the way I teach church history, historical theology, all right? I suppose that if you were approaching this particular discipline from a standpoint that might more properly be called church history, that you might divide it a different way. And you know that the common way of dividing church history is into four parts: early, medieval, Reformation, and modern. But I'm pretty convinced that, looked at from the standpoint of the development of doctrine, which is my major interest, and I think the major interest of the science of theology in this particular department of theology, I'm pretty convinced that we ought to divide church history into three parts: early, and then what I'll frankly call Augustinian, and then modern. And these periods roughly correspond to the year, from the years 100 to 400, 400 to about 1650, and then modern to 1650 to the present. Now, the reason for that has everything to do with the kind of topics that dominated doctrinal discussion during this period of time. The subjects that dominated the early church are canon, Trinity, and person of Christ. Of course, especially this last subject is going to go out into medieval church history, and there's going to be a lot of discussion. But it's the peculiar contributions of Augustine that dominate both his period of time, Augustine himself, and medieval and Reformation church history. And the way that looks is basically this. Augustine is going to kind of set the agenda by his writings for the kind of things that are going to be discussed for the next 1,000 years and more. He's going to be talking about the issue of the doctrine of man, the doctrine of grace, how the sacraments fit into that, how the church fits into that. And these are subjects that have their beginning here, their discussion here, and their resolution in different ways at the Reformation. The Reformation is still going to be talking about subjects that had their first clear manifestation and discussion with Augustine, and especially his doctrine of grace. So, because the whole point of the Reformation centers on the application of salvation, and that's the subject upon which the last four treatises of Augustine's life are going to focus in his anti-Pelagian writings on the doctrine of grace and the application of salvation. And then spiraling around this doctrine of grace and this doctrine of man are going to be the subjects of the sacraments and the church and those kind of issues. So, modern church history begins, as the word modern itself tells you, with the Enlightenment in the 1650s to 1700, and it begins to discuss a whole range of different issues that take you away from the things that had dominated discussion during the Augustinian period to issues that are raised by the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. All right? So that's the reason for the structure of this course and for the fact that I'm dealing with Augustine, medieval church history, and Reformation church history all in this one course, historical theology too. So with that being said and laying that kind of foundation, let's go to the notes proper here. Augustinian beginnings. This is part one, introduction. Warfield cites the great German historian Adolf Harnack, and he tells us that Augustine has been strikingly called incomparably the greatest man whom, between Paul the Apostle and Luther the Reformer, the Christian Church has possessed. I used to tell the students that the greatest Christian that ever lived after the apostles was not Billy Graham, was was Augustine of Hippo. And I believe that with the possible exception of Martin Luther, that that's true. And I'm not even sure that Martin Luther is actually an exception to that. And here's what Warfield says. He gathered up into himself all that the old world had to offer, and recoining it, sent it forth again, bearing the stamp of his profound character. It belonged to the peculiarity of his genius that he embraced all that he took up into himself, not with his heart alone, for the heart does not think, nor with the mind only. He never grasped truth in the abstract and as if it were dead, but with his whole being, giving himself to it and sending it forth from himself as living truth, driven on by all the force of his great and inspiring personality. Accordingly, when having tested the force of his great having tested everything that the old world had to offer and found it wanting, he gave himself at last to Catholic Christianity. It was with no reserves. Catholicism, frankly accepted as such, became his passion, and into the enthusiastic maintenance of it he threw all his forces. It was primarily as a Catholic Christian, therefore, that he thought and worked and lived. But the man who threw himself with such zeal into the service of Catholic Christianity was a man who had already lived through many experiences and gathered much spoil in the process. He had sounded the depths of heresy. We're going to see how he became a Manichee for much of his early life. In its most attractive form, it had drunk the waters of philosophy. He was a trained philosopher in Greek philosophy, read many philosophical treatises of the day. He had drunk the waters of philosophy in his culminating development. Life in the conventicles of the sex and in the circle of cultured heathenism was alike familiar to him. But above all, the spoil he brought from without, he brought with himself. He brought with him himself. He was a man of the highest and most individual genius, intellectual, but far beyond that, religious, who had his own personal contribution to make to thought and life. If we cannot quite allow that there were in very truth many Augustines, we must at least recognize that within the one Augustine, there were very various and not always consistent currents flowing, each of which had his part to play in the future. Within the Catholic Christian, a philosopher of the first rank was restlessly active, and within both, a religious genius of the highest order was working, while for the expression of the resulting complex of feelings and ideas, a literary talent was available second to none in the annals of the church. Well, that's Warfield's assessment of Augustine and his Tertullian Augustine. So with that introduction, I want to come to an overview of his life. And the outline of his life is not difficult, and it does break down, I think, in three fairly clear periods. First period, birth to conversion, that's 354 to 385. Second period, conversion to ordination, a 5-year period of time before he became a priest and the bishop-elect of Hippo, and then the third period, ordination to death, AD 391 to 430, so that he lived something on the order of 76 years. All right? So first of all, introduction to his life. And the first thing we have to talk about here is Africa, and let's see if I can do this. John, I'm not getting this up on the screen. This is a map, as you can see, of the Roman Empire a century before Augustine's birth. That's kind of small in the scale there. I'm going to increase it in just a second. But if you see Italy, the big leg with the boot on the end, ready to kick Sicily across the Mediterranean Sea there. If you just follow from the tip of the boot over to North Africa, the little peninsula there, and the orange part is where Augustine was born, in the province of what Brown calls Old Numidia, but I don't think that's what it was called during this period of the Roman Empire. Now, let me give you a little, I'll see what we can do here. Again, this is kind of a preview, and I hope, I know this map isn't wonderful. It's one of the best I could find on the internet for you. Augustine is born in the furthest, as you see the purple stars there. But Augustine is born down there in Numidia, the country called Numidia there, in a town, and it's hard to read it, but it's Tagas, T-H-A-G-A-S-T-E. He's going to be educated in the famous North African town that centuries before had been the adversary of Rome, Carthage, and that's the other star there in northern Africa. And then almost due north across the Mediterranean Sea is and there's the five-pointed star for Rome, Roma. You can barely see that. The lettering is blurry. And then he's going to later in his life move up to the north of Italy, Italia, as it was called then, and live and work, and this is where he's going to be converted, in the town of Milan in northern Italy. Okay? So that gives you some sense of where you are to locate him geographically. All right? All right, so the first point with regard to his life is Africa. Africa was the continent on which he was born. Augustine was born in a Roman town in proconsular Numidia. That means a province of the Roman Empire ruled by a proconsul. The town Tagaste is modern Souk Ahras in Algeria. Carthage is actually modern Tunis in Tunisia. That's interesting. Carthage was the capital of proconsular Numidia. Tagaste was a town of Romans, farmers in the breadbasket of Rome, proconsular Numidia. Brown remarks. And by the way, then if you know your history, 2nd century BC, there are these series of Punic Wars between Rome and its empire and Carthage and its empire. This is where Hannibal comes from, when he takes his armies across Africa, up through Spain, down through northern Italy to attack Rome with his elephants and everything. This is where he comes from. Of course, Carthage lost the Punic Wars, was sacked and rebuilt as a Roman colony. Now, Brown remarks, since the 1st century B.C., of course, after the end of the Punic Wars, an economic miracle had transformed the hinterland of northern Africa. Never again would prosperity be extended so effectively over so wide an area. By the 3rd century A.D., the high plains and valleys of the plateau, the old Numidia, where Augustine was born, had been planted with grain, crisscrossed with roads, settled with towns. Even further south, beyond the Ores Mountains, a chain of forts guarded the boundary between intensive cultivation and its absence on the very edge of the Sahara. By the 4th century, the original expansion had come to a sinister halt. Schemes for building had stopped. The old public monuments had begun to crumble. Shanty towns as chaotic as the winding lanes of the bazaars of an Arab town had come to press in around the checkerboard avenues of the old Roman cities. With this physical decline came increasing stratification of society. This is Brown still, between rich and poor, and increasing taxes, increasingly authoritarian rule from Rome to protect its breadbasket. For the emperors defending the northern frontiers, against all the barbarian armies coming down from the north, Africa was merely a reliable source of taxes, the heavily administered granary of Rome. And so when the emperors talked about giving the mob of Rome bread and circuses, this is where the bread came from, northern Africa. Now, society was divided into three classes. It was divided into the patroni, or the fathers, or the great Roman landowners. An example of this, and the patron of Augustine's own family, is a man by the name of Romanianus. And he was an example of one of these patroni. Then there was the ordinary Roman citizenry, of whom Patricius, Augustine's father, was one. And then the lowest class were the native and subservient peasantry. Many of the Donatists that we'll talk about in the last lecture tonight were of this class. Patricius, Augustine's father, was a Roman citizen, and so therefore was Augustine, but he was poor. And so you had, what you had here was a kind of triangle with the great Roman landowners, the ordinary Roman citizens, and then the peasants. And this stratification of society was becoming, as Brown said, more extreme during the years in which Augustine lived. Now, Brown goes on to say, to be a full member of a Roman town, Augustine had to be free and civilized. But he did not have to be rich. His father, Patricius, was a poor man. The Latin is quoted here, a tenuus municeps. That is to say, a slender citizen or something like that, meaning he was poor, but a citizen. A burgess, or a citizen freeman of slender means. Augustine will grow up in a hard, competitive world among proud and impoverished gentlefolk. A classical education was one of the only passports to success for such men, and he narrowly avoided losing even this. His early life will be overshadowed by the sacrifices his father made to give him this vital education. Patricius and his family had to go poorly dressed. He had to scrape. Yet Patricius could claim, perhaps as a relative, the patronage of the local grandee, Romanianus. Augustine's success was greatly helped by this relationship. It's probably wrong even to raise it and misguided, but, you know, even as far back as that, you had the Italian families. But, of course, in this case, nothing to do with the mafia. But, so Romanianus was the head of the family of which Augustine's poor family was a part. And when he says that they had to go poorly dressed, I imagine Monica, his mother, had little problem with going poorly dressed in order to get her son the education that they wanted for him. And that is who we come to secondly, Monica. Monica, Augustine's mother, was the dominating figure in his family life. I don't mean to say necessarily that she was domineering, but she was a vigorous woman. She made sure the household was Christian and that her children, and Augustine did have brothers and sisters, although we won't say a lot about them, she made sure that her household was Christian, that her children were brought up to be Christians, even though Patricius, her husband, was not. Brown tells us, however, that both parents, quote, had one quality in common, determination. Patricius showed, quote, pig-headed resolution to get his son educated. Monica especially showed great determination. This was shown by her eventually following Augustine, the child of her prayers, across the Mediterranean to Milan. She actually left home, went to Carthage, and took a boat across the Mediterranean. So you can imagine a woman doing this in that day, and to be near her son so that she could watch out for him and guide him and keep him, if possible, from the wrong path. Through the faithful and resolute prayers and exhortations and life of Monica, Patricius, apparently, shortly before his death, and Augustine, as we know, later in life, both became Christians. And that brings us, after that introduction, to the first period of Augustine's life, birth to conversion, AD 354 to 385. And first of all, under this, Boyhood in the School at Tagaste. We don't know exactly how long this lasted, exactly when he left Tagaste for Medora, where he went to, you could either say high school or college, but then you're going to have to say Carthage's graduate school. But anyway, a Boyhood in the School at Tagaste, 354 to question mark, probably someplace in the 360s. Augustine's early education was marked by two things. One, a Catholic religious training. By the way, don't be reading everything into that word Catholic that we read today. We're simply talking about the church in North Africa that was in fellowship with the rest of the church and the rest of the Roman Empire. The word Catholic means universal, and I'm not saying Roman Catholic. That would, in fact, be wrong to say. I'm saying Catholic, okay? A Catholic religious training, that is to say, the kind of Christian training that young people received all over the Roman Empire. A Catholic religious training. Augustine was a catechumen from infancy, that is to say, under the instruction of the church, though he was not, as we will see, baptized as an infant, which is a striking thing. The second thing that characterized this early education was a strict classical education, and strict in this context means, Alex, accompanied by frequent floggings. In fact, he had such a brutal Greek teacher that it was one of the reasons he didn't ever learn Greek too well, because he rebelled against his Greek teacher because of the brutal he was. At any rate, let's look at the strict classical education. A, its content. Brown says, Augustine will be educated to become a master of the spoken word. The content of his education was barren. It was frankly pagan. It was surprisingly meager. He would have read far fewer classical writings. Brown must be British, because this certainly isn't true of America. Far fewer classical writings than a modern schoolboy. Virgil, Cicero, Sallust, and Terence were the only authors studied in detail. It was exclusively literary. Philosophy, science, and history were alike ignored. Many assert, and this is an interesting question, you can read all sorts of fun stuff on the internet about this, that though he was taught it, Augustine failed to learn Greek. There are scholars who, however, who question this assertion. After looking around on the subject a little bit, I concluded that the fact is this. He rebelled as a young man against a brutal Greek teacher, but the fact is that later his writings show that he knew Greek. He often uses Greek words in his writings and uses them correctly. So it's not true that he was completely ignorant of Greek. It is likely, however, that he was not the master of the Greek language that we might expect from someone as great as Augustine to be. All right? A goal. Brown specifies the goal of Augustine's education. The ideal product of this education was the orator. A man, that is, who could give pleasure throughout his argument by his vivacity, by the feelings at his command, by the ease with which words came to him, perfectly adapted to address his message and style. The great advantage of the education Augustine received was that within its narrow limits, it was perfectionist. The aim was to measure up to the timeless perfection of the ancient classic. Above all, this education would have taught Augustine to express himself. And, of course, we can scarcely miss the providence of God in this kind of preparation for his life when Augustine is going to spend his mature life as a preacher of the Word of God. In about 368, at least, he is at Medora. How should we think about this? Well, maybe we should think about it like some kid from Ohio County moving, finishing high school and moving up here to go to OCC or to Kentucky Wesleyan or Brescia for a couple of years before he goes on over to the University of Kentucky. That's what Medora was. It was his early college years, his late high school years, something like that. Brown remarks, Medora was a university town with a distinctive atmosphere. It boasts the great Platonist and order of the second century, Apuleius, the teachers at Medora were pagans. Now, in the year 370 and 371, this is a very significant year for Augustine, Brown says he had to wait a year until Patricius had saved enough money to complete his education at Carthage. So he's been there at Medora at least a couple of years. He has to come home because Dad doesn't have enough money to send him off to Carthage to school. And during this year at home, there's a famous incident that is famous because Augustine recounts it in his Confessions with regard to certain stolen pears. Apparently he and some buddies, for no good reason, and not because they were hungry, vandalized the neighbor's pear tree, stole his pears, and went out in the fields and enjoyed themselves throwing the pears at pigs. We'll come back to that in a few minutes, because Augustine has a lot of learned a lot about himself spiritually from that event. That year also saw the onset of sexual sin in his life, which is going to continue and be a major factor preparing and preparing him through conviction of sin about it for his conversion some 15 or 20 years later. D, he finishes his education at Carthage, AD 371 to 375. In 372, Augustine's sexual sin culminates in his taking a concubine, which is apparently not a very unusual thing to happen in that day and age. The concubine was a kind of second-class marriage. He continued this relationship for 15 years with this woman, had a son by her, and we don't even know her name. So wonderful are these kind of non-marital relationships between men and women. 15 years with a woman, we don't even know her name from his writings, from the millions of words that Augustine wrote. Anyway, such relationships were commonly accepted, sadly, even by Christians, though Augustine would later condemn them, that is to say, he condemned the practice of concubinage when he was a bishop. So he was condemning what he himself had practiced before he was a Christian. In 372 as well, his father Patricius dies. In 373, his son Adeodatus is born. Adeodatus, Adeodatus, from God given, is the name of his son. In 373, Augustine reads the Hortensius of Cicero, the exhortation to wisdom is what that Hortensius is. He is inspired by this work to seek wisdom, that is to say, what they would have done in that day is study philosophy. He's also disappointed about this time and the style of the Latin scriptures. The Atala, the old Northern African Latin translation of the Bible, had been done very early on. Probably had been done kind of helter-skelter by different Christians, and not by Christians who were greatly skilled in Latin. And so Augustine, the Latin scholar, now begins to read the Atala, the Bible of the Northern Africa himself, and being the young scholar that he is frankly disappointed in the style of the Latin Bible, and his folly. This is a reason for him to turn against Christianity. 373, thus he becomes a Manichaean hearer. We're going to talk about Manichaeism in later tonight. But for the next 9 years, from 373 all the way to about 382, he was a Manichaean and enthusiastic proselytizer for them. Manichaeists were divided into the perfect and the hearers. He never became one of the perfect, but he was a hearer and a teacher of Manichaeism for the next 9 years. This is very significant because Manichaeism was very prevalent on the move in that day and age, and Augustine, after he becomes a Christian, is going to become the hammer of Manichaeism because of his own experience in it. But we'll talk about that later. Finishing his college education at Carthage, maybe we might even say in our day and age, his master's degree, he begins a teaching career at Carthage and teaches there from 375 to 383, all this time as a Manichae. Now, in 382, through contact with another wing of Manichaeism, Augustine begins to question his earlier commitment to this religion. Though informed that one of the well-known leaders of, and apparently someone who was renowned as quite scholarly, a man by the name of Faustus of Milevus, he's informed that Faustus could settle his doubts that he's beginning to have about Manichaeism, yet when he actually meets Faustus, he's pretty disillusioned by what he regards as his comparatively uneducated person. To quote, to judge from this man's pamphlets, he had addressed his appeals to the educated group to which Augustine himself belonged. Apparently, Manichaeism had, there are different kinds of it. There was a kind of Manichaeism that was big time among college students, and it took on a certain character. There was also a more fundamentalist kind of Manichaeism that was spread by merchants and middle class kind of people. In fact, spread so far that there were actually Manichaean settlements in China that we'll hear about later on. Anyway, to judge from this man's pamphlets, he had addressed his appeals to the educated group, the college kind of scene, which Augustine had himself belonged. He had gained a vast reputation for learning, conveniently maintained by his frequent absences on missionary journeys, so people couldn't really check him out, I guess the point. Here indeed was a top party member who would explain everything. When Faustus arrived in Carthage in 383, Augustus could see for himself what sort of man controlled the movement in the Latin world. Quote, I found at once that the man was not learned in any of the liberal studies save literature, and not especially learned in that either. So in 383, Augustine leaves Africa for Rome. Now, apparently, her husband being dead, Monica had arrived in Carthage, determined either to go with Augustine to Rome or to make him preferably stay in Carthage. Well, I don't know what the entire story is. I'm not sure anybody does, but Augustine, the rat fink, tricks his own mother into missing the boat and leaves for Rome without her, okay? Now, you young men maybe can understand that a little bit, but it still wasn't a very nice thing to do. At any rate, that brings us to Rome, A.D. 383 to 384. Seriously ill upon arrival, Augustine still stays with the Manichaeans. And he doesn't have any choice. He's really ill. The Manichaeans will take him in, take care of him. He's the only contacts. They're the only contacts he has. And so he says that he continues on, but his attachment to their doctrines was not, he says, after he was in Rome, with its, quote, ancient eagerness. During this time in Rome, he was recommended by the Manichaeans to the pagan Symmachus, for the post of professor of rhetoric at Milan. I think Symmachus was a Roman senator, had a lot of say in, probably controlled these kind of appointments. So he had this interview with the senator Symmachus, and he excelling in a speech before him, which is what you would do. You go show your stuff by giving a speech. He is appointed the post of professor of rhetoric at Milan, and Augustine has hit the big time. All right? Now, so he goes to Milan in the year 384, and lo and behold, his mom shows up. Monica arrives. Now, here's some stuff that happens that probably make you shake your head. I know it makes me shake my head. She arranges a marriage for him with a Catholic heiress who is 2 years underage. Now think about this. He's been living with his concubine for 15 years. He has a son by her. But, of course, she's peasant stock. She's not a worthy wife for the professor of rhetoric at Milan. And so Monica, Christian Monica, arranges a marriage. Now, this heiress, this Catholic heiress that's more befitting his station, is 2 years underage. Now, I think, I wouldn't be dogmatic, but I believe this is true, that means she's 12 years old. She can't get married till she's 14. Okay? But as a hindrance to this arrangement, Augustine's concubine is sent away. And she leaves, vowing never to know another man, and this probably has something to do with her wanting to get baptized as a concubine. She apparently hadn't been baptized into the church. But there's some speculation about that. But, of course, now Augustine faces 2 years without sex and improving his complete bondage to his sexual sin. Unable to abstain for 2 years, Augustine procures another concubine. And as I said, his original concubine vows never to know another man and returns to Africa, leaving her son with Augustine. Of concubinage, Brown says, even the Catholic Church was prepared to recognize it, provided they were faithful to one another. Pope Leo said that to abandon one's concubine in order to take a wife in legitimate matrimony was not bigamy, but a sign of moral improvement. Shake your head, don't you? Wow. It's only encouraging this way. We thought we lived in the most corrupt age ever to exist, but it was pretty bad back then, too. Augustine would later condemn this course. He says, quote, if you have no wives, you may not have concubines, women whom you will later dismiss in order to marry a wife. Of course, that's exactly what he had done. Chadwick remarks, how conventional and respectable this then was is illustrated by a canon of a Spanish synod of 400 decreeing that so long as a man was faithful to his concubine as if she was his wife, their relationship constituted no bar to communion. Pope Leo I thought monogamy preserved if a man left his concubine to contract a legal marriage. Whew. How sad, huh? How sad. Well, I think that is a pretty good place to stop and take questions, both from you here in class and elsewhere. Go ahead. Dave? Latin. Yeah. He spoke a Latin, was raised Latin, was trained in Latin, which is why his knowledge of Greek was, you know, somewhat. Yes. Dave just asked me to what language Augustine spoke, and he spoke Latin. That was his mother tongue. Other questions? I'm waiting a second to give time for the people out in TV land to chat with me if they want to. All right, we'll take a break right now then, and we'll get started again right at 7:30.